It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's a man who willingly became a kitchen slave. Former New Yorker magazine editor Bill Buford asked himself, could he cook in a professional kitchen? Well, the answer is in his book, Heat, An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting Butcher in Tuscany. The Sterns are at Nick's Famous Roast Beef in Beverly, Massachusetts. Forget the grill and a rickety table. We have a designer's take on the latest in outdoor kitchens. One Tank Wonders has us day tripping from Austin, Texas. Think pie happy hour. Then it's the new food TV season from Television Without Pity. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's a successful New Yorker magazine editor who thought he'd take off 6 months to answer his own deeply pressing question. Was he good enough to cook in a professional kitchen? 3 years later, Bill Buford wrote Heat, An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner talks the latest supposed essential, the outdoor kitchen, even in the snow belt. Then it's pie happy hour in a German beer garden in the latest edition of One Tank Wonders. We're day tripping from Austin, Texas. Television Without Pity's critic Linda Holmes takes on the new season in food TV. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years. Jane and Michael write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, have you noticed how difficult it is to get a good roast beef sandwich these days?
You mean one that isn't gray? Because everything is well done. Everything is well done these days.
Yeah, or it's cut on a machine and it's gray and it's slimy or it's soggy. Roast beef sandwiches are really one of my favorite things in the world. And until Michael and I went to North Beverly, Massachusetts, which is the home of just one roast beef sandwich place after another, it didn't occur to me how much I'd been missing. But we found one called Nick's Famous Roast Beef, and I was just happy as a pig in slop. I was going to say a clam in slop.
No, let me go just back, because it's not just Nick's Famous Roast Beef that does this. All along the North Shore of Massachusetts, there are probably several dozen places that make roast beef sandwiches a specialty. People who grew up there know Kelly's Roast Beef. That's the name of the restaurant. Uh-huh. It's kind of a shoreline thing at Revere Beach. All around, people specialize in roast beef sandwiches. And of course, the point is to serve the most, the pinkest, the juiciest, the most delicious roast beef on an excellent bun with whatever condiments the place specializes in.
Oh.
But it's really good at Nick's.
You would like this beef, Lynn, because it's real pink. I mean, it's just the way it should be.
Well, it's sliced thin, but not so thin that it's really juicy, despite the fact that it's sliced thin, and it's piled very high. And if you get the super beef sandwich, which you definitely want, it comes on this really wonderful kind of eggy roll that is encrusted all around the top with caramelized onions.
Mm. If we were in a different universe, I would say this was a brioche, but it's not. But it's kind of eggy and yellow like a brioche.
What comes with it? I mean, what kind of condiments do you use?
Well, you get your choice of condiments. I mean, there's, you know, whatever, horseradish, cheese you can put on top, mayo, mustard. But what most people get at Nick's, and what I would recommend to anybody going to Nick's for the first time, is this barbecue sauce that they make. Now, it's nothing like barbecue sauce at a barbecue restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a spicy, sweet, kind of orangey, reddish stuff with a lot of zest. It just matches the beef and, of course, the onion-topped roll perfectly.
But, you know, that doesn't do it for me. What I like is their horseradish sauce.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good.
Because, to me, rare roast beef and horseradish is, you know, the most blissful combination.
Yeah. Is Nick's a place where you sit and eat, or do you just do
barely.
Takeout?
No,
barely.
You kind of hover.
And no, there are tables. I mean, there are obviously no tablecloths, no utensils, because no utensils are needed. The only thing other than roast beef that anybody needs to know about on the menu are these really, really good onion rings. But the great thing about Nick's, other than the fact that it's just kind of a bare table, stand up and order, even the rough type place, is that the decor is so monomaniacal. All the walls are covered everywhere with snapshots that people have taken of themselves all around America and the world, showing them standing in front of famous places, monuments, and buildings, holding up a bumper sticker that says, Nick's Roast Beef, We're the only one.
Well, you know, can't blame the guy for advertising. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, autumn is closing in. Last week, I tried to buy tomatoes from every farmer in the market who was growing heirlooms. I figure if farmers are taking the risk, you've got to support them. Now, I could barely make it to the car. This week, I bring the donkey to carry the bags. This heirloom thing, though, is amazing. From one or two growers last year, we now have 12, 13. In fact, one farmer is doing 50-some varieties. But here's the risky part. Heirlooms originally were backyard tomatoes. They were meant to go from the vine to the kitchen. They're thin-skinned. Now, for the farmer, that thin skin means you could lose half your crop before you get to market. Now, the big discovery this summer was Russian and Ukrainian tomatoes, the blacks. Well, they're really kind of a dark purpley red. Anyway, the flavors are amazingly rich. Check out things like black crims, black Russians, and gypsy blacks. The other big thing for we tomato-obsessed types is that this is the most poignant time of year. We must celebrate our own primal tomato while they last. Now, for me, it's this particular sandwich. I call it the Last of the Tomatoes commemorative sandwich. Just take plenty of napkins. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Deborah Krasner could be on her way to being one of the food world's renaissance women. She's a professional cook, a book author, and she designs kitchens for the likes of Marcella Hazan. Her takes on thinking out kitchen space always start us rethinking things. Deborah, it's good to have you back.
Thank you for that incredible introduction.
It's true.
Hey,
it's
I'm true. Glad to be back.
I've got to know something from the design point of view, okay? What is the deal with outdoor kitchens?
I think they're the trend of the future. But what's interesting about outdoor kitchens is that they're not just about guys flipping burgers on grills anymore. They're really about serious cooking in ways that you just can't do inside, with much more intense heat or much slower, more gentle heat, to do food in ways with flavors you never can achieve on indoor domestic equipment.
Give me an example of what an outdoor kitchen has to have. I mean, what are the elements of an outdoor kitchen?
Outdoor kitchens run the gamut from, you know, a circle of stones with a grill and charcoal to really elaborate six-figure stainless steel equipment and counters, refrigerators, sinks, and wood-fired ovens. So there's a big range.
But no, wait, there's a whole part of the country that has something called winter, and that goes on for a very long time.
I live in one of those places in the country, as do you, and I would have thought outdoor kitchen, forget about it. We have like a 9-week window of summer.
Right.
But I can tell you, I built an outdoor kitchen, and we went out in January and grilled outside. It was fun.
So, okay, I'm thinking of this. You've told me the basic elements. I'd love to have an example of two things, two extremes, the all-out, no-holes-barred outdoor kitchen, and then the real poor man's version of the outdoor kitchen.
Okay. The no-holes-barred version. It has a roof. It's under a pavilion. It has a big, powerful gas grill with side burners so that you can cook with the flick of a switch. It has a fabulous charcoal cooker, such as the Big Green Egg, a big, wonderful smoker grill.
Mm-hmm.
It has a sink with hot and cold running water. It has a refrigerator. And it has a wood-fired pizza oven.
Oh, wow.
That's top of the line. You got everything
okay.
There is.
All right.
Plus an electric smoker.
Okay, now, I don't really want to spend very much money at all.
There are all kinds of very small, very durable, useful charcoal grills that are remarkably inexpensive. And really all you need for an outdoor kitchen is a grill and a surface. That surface can be a dining table. It can be a prep table. It can be a piece of wood put over some logs, stumps.
It could be almost anything.
But the point is you need a place to put food down, to plate it, to prep it. And that's all you need. That's an outdoor kitchen.
You know, I have to confess, the one thing I would want to blow money on is that wood-fired oven. What are the choices out there? I know they can be very expensive. Are there any really good bargains out there?
There is one. Most wood-fired ovens, you either build them yourself or you have a mason build them for you, or you buy a kit. And those kits basically run $3,000 to $5,000 just for the kits. And they're cast cement pieces that you have a mason or you put together, and then they get insulated and encased. Mm-hmm. So that's generally in the $5,000 to $10,000 range once you're through with it. Hmm. There is, however, a cast cement one-piece pizza oven from South Africa that's just started getting imported into this country. The guy who's importing it is in Chicago. His name's Tom Nicolai. And it's called Papa's Pizza Oven. It's painted a kind of terracotta color. It comes in a big crate. It takes about two people to move it. It's 300 or 400 pounds. It arrives on little short metal feet. The whole thing can go on top of a picnic table that's had a piece of cement board put on top of it. Then you put this Papa's Pizza Oven on it, and you can be cooking pizza in it the day it arrives. It needs no installation. It never needs to be encased. And, you know, it's good to go. You can take it with you if you move.
So how much is it?
It's $2,500.
Oh, that's not bad. Not when you're looking at $10,000.
Exactly. It's a relative bargain.
So you think this kitchen, outdoor kitchen thing is going to last?
I do think it's going to last because I think that we all get such pleasure out of cooking outside. I think the smells are different. Mm-hmm. I think the food is different. And it's perfect for entertaining. It makes it easy.
Deb, thank you.
Thank you.
Kitchen designer and cookbook author Deborah Krasner works out of her studio in Vermont. She's author of The Flavors of Olive Oil, a tasting guide and cookbook. Coming up, one man's adventures as a kitchen slave and one tank wonders in Austin, Texas. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. What moves a man to become a slave? Now, I'm talking about a man of mid-age, established in his field. I'm talking about writer and editor Bill Buford. Bill was fiction editor at The New Yorker and an ambitious, if somewhat hysterical, home cook. And one day, he decided to apprentice in Mario Batali's Babbo Restaurant Kitchen. And that's when the wild ride began. Bill is author of Heat, An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany. Bill, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Bill, to get a picture of what you walked into in that Babo kitchen, I'd like you to read a passage from the book. And it begins with, carrots are not shaped like cubes. Could you read that for us?
And indeed, they're not shaped like cubes. This is during my tenure as a slave, when I discovered that a carrot is not shaped like a cube. And so to trim one up, you first had to cut it into a long rectangle, then cut it into thin 1-millimeter planks, and then take your 1-millimeter planks and cut them into long 1-millimeter slivers, and then take your perfectly formed slivers and chop, 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 cut them into 1-millimeter cubes. I seem to have done my first batch almost right. Either that, or it was late and everyone was in a hurry, and no one looked too closely at the geometric mishmash in the container I'd filled. My second batch involved 36 carrots. It took me a long time to cube 36 carrots. Normally, the prep chef, Elisa, popped round to make sure I wasn't mangling what I was working on, but she must have trusted me with the carrots. After all, what can you do to a carrot? So when she finally looked in, I was almost done. She shrieked. I said, fine dice! This is not fine dice! I don't know what they are, but they're wrong! I've been cutting carrots for 2 hours, and then, like that, they were tossed. They were that bad. I wanted to weep. It took me 3 days before I could tell anyone about the experience. She threw away my carrots, all of them. And even then, I could hear the quiver of indignation in my voice. It was a month later that I finally succeeded in getting the carrots right, although the achievement... Wow, Elisa said, picking up my 4-quart container and dumping the contents into a braising liquid. These are good. Was secretly marred by my having covertly eaten several hundred imperfect little squares.
Bill, why? Why were you subjecting yourself to this?
You know, it was just the beginning. I'd always wanted to work in a kitchen. That's not quite true. I always wanted to know what chefs know. Mm-hmm. I wanted that kind of knowledge. I liked cooking for whatever complicated or not complicated reason, whatever zen pleasure I got out of cooking, I got that pleasure. And I wanted more. I wanted to know more. I got so much from cookbooks, and I got so much from hacking around in the kitchen, but I wanted what chefs know. And when the opportunity came that I've been asked to write about Mario Batali for The New Yorker, I thought, well, here's a chance to work in a kitchen. I'll write about Mario if he'll let me work in the kitchen. And he was very skeptical at first, but he let me in. And I worked, originally probably going to work about a month or two, and I ended up working 6 months, writing a big piece for The New Yorker. I was nevertheless frustrated that I didn't get everything I wanted to get into the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And when it appeared, several friends had suggested, you know, this is pretty interesting stuff. You might want to think about doing a book. And I had Mario over for dinner. He very wisely cooked the meal. And then I put to him, after 3 bottles of wine and before we'd even started, that maybe he'd let me get back into the kitchen and then I could work a year and write a book about it. And I did. But even then, it wasn't enough. I sort of reached a point where I thought, well, why not go to Italy,
mm-hmm.
which is what Mario had done. And so I thought, well, why not that too? And decided to go to Italy for 2 weeks and came back and then thought, you know, why not go back? And by the end, it was 3 years, and I'd gone through, you know, more than a year at the Babo kitchen, and I'd been in the mountains to learn how to make pasta from the woman who taught Mario how to make pasta, and I became an Italian butcher.
You studied under a man who is considered by many to be one of the great butchers of the world. Could you describe him, that first impression that you had of him?
That could take a book. Dario is regarded as the most famous butcher in Italy, and since I don't think the world is crowded with famous butchers, it's quite possible he's the most famous butcher in the world. I arrived on a Sunday morning with my wife, having persuaded her to give up her high-paid, high-powered magazine editorial job and accompany me to Italy, where we'd make no money, and if I was lucky, I'd do more than chop carrots. And the place, 11 o'clock in the morning, was packed. I mean, really, really packed. It's a small little butcher shop. And elbow to elbow, everybody crushed together. There were maybe 200 people, and there were another 100 people on the outside. Everybody was drunk. There was a man in a suit going around with a giant fiasco of Chianti, which he was semi-pouring into people's glasses, more often was pouring on their feet. There's another man going around with raw pig fat, lardo, which he was giving to people, and it was all over his face like toothpaste. And there at the top was this tremendous figure, Dario Cecchini, and people were kind of braying for his attention. They were giving him pieces of paper, orders, autographs, money, and he She was oblivious to them all, and the music was playing very, very loud. I think it was Mozart's Requiem. And then he spotted me and commanded silence and then started reciting Dante's Inferno, and the whole place just erupted in an uproar of sweaty adrenaline, hysterical excitement.
Bill, I'm thinking you tracked Mario's teachers, and the book is about three pretty extreme personalities: Mario, Dario, and then someone we haven't mentioned, Marco Pierre White, who is the British chef that Mario first worked with. Is this kind of madness necessary for great food? Is that really the key?
The madness in each one of them.
Yeah.
I don't think it is necessarily, but I think the madness that you see in all of them is a kind of a passionate belief in food, which is a strange thing. And I've come to think of it as the charisma of food. Food, unlike most things in our lives, is always on the verge of meaning so many things.
Mm-hmm.
It's what your mother made. It's what your grandmother made. It's family. It's also history, and you get that in Italy more than anywhere else. Dario Cecchini was always going on about the great Medicis and how the height of Renaissance cooking was the height of Italian food. It's also identity and nationality, and it's art. Ever since the 3rd century, people have talked about the art of cooking. It's all these things, and yet finally, it's dinner, and it's gone. But with all these people, with Mario and Dario and Marco Pierre White, they all believe in kind of the charisma of what food is. Food is always on the verge of meaning so many things. And to work in a kitchen, especially an urban kitchen in the United States or Britain, is to work in a place under such phenomenal pressure that there's this whole other thing going on, which is kind of adrenaline thrill. And I think all of them on some level are adrenaline junkies.
Yeah. Bill Buford, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Buford is author of Heat, An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany. We've been talking to food people around the country about day trips, one-tank wonders that'll get us into great local food. Well, the Austin Chronicle has a columnist who devotes himself to the Texas travel scene. Gerald McLeod's alias is Captain Day Trips. Gerald, welcome.
Hello, Lynn. How are you today?
I am good. Now, I know that the city of Austin has a lot going on, but what are your favorite picks for us to get out of town on a tank of gas?
If you're going to talk about food outside of Austin, I think you almost have to start with barbecue.
Well, I must say, when I think Texas, I think barbecue right off the bat.
So. Well, good, good. Well, if I really had to pick one barbecue place that I'd say, Lynn, you got to go to this place, it would be down in Luling called Luling City Market. And I think my favorite about the Luling City Market has to be their sausage. Even though they make a really good brisket and ribs, down here it's pork ribs. That's about the only thing we barbecue is pork ribs or maybe a pork chop.
So the rest of it's all beef, right?
You bet. Brisket is what barbecue is supposed to be.
So you've got Luling City Market, but can you eat there? Where would you go to eat?
Yes, you order by the pound, and they serve it up on red butcher paper. And then they've moved everything out and put in tables so you can eat right there. And they have some side dishes. In Texas, barbecue doesn't always come with side dishes, but they have a really nice creamy potato salad, some coleslaw, and wonderful cobblers. Barbecue and cobbler goes together real well. Am I making you hungry yet?
Yeah, I'm very hungry. I always associate the area around Austin and then San Antonio, which is nearby, as an area where there were a lot of German settlers. Can you still get some great German food?
Oh, you can indeed. And you're absolutely right. Right after the Civil War, the Germans came in and started buying up the old plantations. And north of Austin, outside of Georgetown, mm-hmm. is this really nice place called Wahlberg Mercantile. And at one time it was the general store, but now it's about 10 years ago, or maybe a little longer, It was purchased by two recent immigrants from Germany. And it is the place to get your knockwurst and bratwurst and wiener schnitzel in the Austin area. And then once you finish eating a big plate of German food, go outside, out back. They have a real nice beer garden covered by a big tent. And they pull out the accordions and the fiddles, and they play all night.
So you can dance after you've eaten?
You bet.
Okay, Gerald, one more pick. Can you take us to one more place?
Okay, gosh, I'd have to say chicken fried steak is the next most popular food in Texas. There's a little place up northwest of Austin called the Bluebonnet Cafe. And it sits on a little hill overlooking Lake Marble Falls, and it's a nice little place. It's been there since the 1930s. And they have a chicken fried steak that you can cut with your fork.
Oh.
And, oh, my wife just loves their meatloaf. Now, that's her favorite. Now, the nice thing about this place is that weekday afternoons, they have pie happy hour for $3. Pie happy hour, because they have a wonderful selection of meringue and fruit pies. For $3, you can get a drink, a cup of coffee, and a big slice of pie. And now on Saturday and Sunday afternoons, it can get a little crowded, but usually in the afternoons during the week, it's a wonderful place. Plus, you're right up there among the Highland Lakes, so there's plenty of swimming holes up there and antique shopping and lots of things to do. In the springtime, the roads are just lined with wildflowers. It's one of the prettiest drives out of Austin that there is, I think.
Well, not a lot of light eating around Austin, but it sounds really good. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Gerald McLeod is day trip columnist for the Austin Chronicle. Yeah, yeah, the new TV season has all these mysteries and lawyer shows and sitcoms, but let's get to the good stuff, the new fall food shows. The woman with the inside word is Linda Holmes. Now, by day, Linda is a lawyer, but by night, she turns ruthless commentator on the TV scene. You can find her critiques on MSNBC and the wonderfully snarky, that's Linda's words, Television Without Pity site. Hey, Linda, it's good to have you back.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So what is coming up?
We have just finished the summer season, and the summer season brought the return of Hell's Kitchen for its second season. That's the show with Gordon Ramsay.
The rudest chef possibly on the planet, right? He's British.
He's British, and he is extraordinarily rude, yeah. And he spends a lot of time calling the cooks donkeys and things like that, and they sweat in the food, and it's all very dramatic. And they had a tough moment for the young chefs when they failed to recognize that the pâté he was serving them was ground-up hot dogs that made them look a little bit silly. But presumably that show will be back at some point. I don't know exactly what the scheduling is for them, but it'll come back, I'm sure. It's been quite successful. And in the fall, you'll also have a new season. I think one of the most anticipated ones will be the new season of Top Chef, which is on Bravo. And that's by some of the same producers who do Project Runway. And Top Chef is, again, a competition show, young chefs. Usually they have different kinds of backgrounds. Some are restaurant chefs and some are more experienced in cooking at home. And they have a similar one person eliminated every week format. And they have challenges, and some of the challenges are really creative and interesting, and some of them are very, very silly.
For instance?
Well, they had one that was sort of interesting where they had to come up with something that could survive being reheated in the microwave, which I thought was kind of an interesting idea.
People
actually struggle with. They also had a challenge where you had to cook with ingredients from a gas station convenience store. That was sort of a little on the sillier end, a lot of nacho cheese dips and things like that on that one. That one's been very successful. I think that one will be hotly anticipated, and I think comes back in October.
Uh-huh.
So there's that one. There's always a lot of activity at the Food Network, obviously. And one of the big pieces of news over there is that is actually something that won't be on or won't be on as much, and that's Rachel Ray.
But she's become their flagship, practically.
Oh, she is their flagship. You can't spit on TV or in a bookstore without hitting Rachel Ray. She is everywhere. And it's a little bit, I think they're having a little bit of a victim of their own success in the sense that she's now so popular that she's been adopted by Oprah, essentially. And now Harpo Productions, which is Oprah's company, is going to do a syndicated talk show with Rachel Ray. So she's going to be devoting more time to that, not as much time to her Food Network shows.
Interesting.
The good news for them on one front is they are getting a new Nigella Lawson show.
But they're shifting because, I mean, I'm just thinking, I mean, Bobby Flay, it seems he never dies, but Molto Mario has been canceled.
I saw that, and I was surprised by that, too. And again, they don't tend to trumpet those announcements, but that did come out at the same time when they were talking about all the shuffling that's going on. And one of the things they've tried to do is they've tried to move their personalities who are popular over to other formats. And I think one of the reasons why they came up with Iron Chef America was that it was, among other things, a spot, a place to put Bobby Flay and Mario Batali that wasn't the kinds of shows they're shifting away from, which are the more pure instruction.
Gourmet Magazine is going to PBS. What do you think about this?
I think, you know, as we've been talking about the Food Network going in a little bit more of a reality or on the road kind of format, here's PBS working with Gourmet Magazine to make a show. It's called Diary of a Foodie, and it's going to be, I think, more of a serious food lover angle as opposed to the more entertainment oriented. And obviously Gourmet Magazine brings a lot to the table if you're going to do that. They have sort of the reputation, they have the resources, they have credibility that new unknown faces on other networks don't really have. So they're sort of stepping into that gap a little bit where it's food aficionados, where maybe some of the other networks have stepped a little bit away from that with the hot dog pate and so forth.
Linda, thank you.
Thank you.
Linda Holmes contributes to MSNBC.com's entertainment pages and is critic for TelevisionWithoutPity.com. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Who was the first male TV cook to cash in on good looks and outrageous behavior? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, who was the first male TV cook to cash in on good looks and outrageous behavior? It wasn't Emeril or Flay or Batali. It was Graham Kerr, also known as the Galloping Gourmet, and it was back in 1969. That's when his Australian cooking show debuted here, and it was an immediate hit. Kerr was the showman of showmen, and he could really cook, as if anybody cared. The idea behind the Galloping Gourmet was that this handsome Englishman was eating his way around the world in great restaurants and bringing home the recipes. Ever with a wine glass in one hand and a pot in another, Kerr was the antithesis of the take one half tablespoon of butter style of TV cook. Cream, butter, booze was hurled into all kinds of recipes. Now, he was reamed for not being a serious cook, but everybody watched. And compared to today, he was so wonderfully loose. He was so himself.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Hefty OneZip. Pick up that phone, guys. Number's 800-537-5252. Let's get going. We have got David from Fargo on the line. David, what do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, thank you for taking my call. We are, I'm getting ready to actually marry the man of my dreams, and I am, we're planning a reception around the pool with hors d'oeuvres and drinks.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
But in order, of course, for us to get married, we have to travel to Winnipeg, which is 3 hours north. And so we're going to Winnipeg on Friday, coming back on Saturday, and having the big party, which means that I get back from Winnipeg 2 hours before before the big party, and I'm self-catering this. So
You're looking for some do-ahead stuff, maybe?
I'm looking for some do-ahead stuff.
Okay. Okay, now, how many people?
About 100.
Okay, small gathering. And you're doing a buffet or just hors d'oeuvre?
Just hors d'oeuvres.
Just hors d'oeuvre. Okay. Well, first of all, very first thing, I'm a firm believer in you have your guests do a bit of the work in the sense that you put out things that they can go over, pick up, you know, spread on the toast or whatever, in addition to, because James Beard, the great American chef and cooking teacher who made his living in his early cooking days in New York City catering, called hors d'oeuvres doots. He called to these little doots that you had to work so hard to do. And,
right.
And I'm thinking of things that you are not going to end up having soggy and whatever, stuff you may be able to put in the freezer
exactly.
or put in the fridge and they're going to be fine, you know, 2 days or whatever later. The first thing that comes to mind is invest in smoked salmon.
Okay.
There's just no question. You put out a side of really good smoked salmon, and you put out some sour cream in a pot, and you put out some sliced scallions and some wedges of lemon and some nice crackers and dark, thick, you know, thin sliced, rather, pumpernickel bread, you know, that heavy bread you can buy in a lot of grocery stores. That's going to keep you everybody's going to love that.
Okay.
And it's so elegant, especially with champagne.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing I think I would do is a spectacular looking big tray or plate of cheeses. And a fun way to do this is even to go out and go to a tile store and buy 12 by 12 slate tiles.
Oh, okay.
And use those for your cheeses because the look of them with the creamy cheeses is just dynamite. So that goes out, and that goes out with an assortment of crackers and breads.
Okay.
And those breads could actually, well, before you leave from Winnipeg, you could have taken them out of the freezer if you, you know, do them ahead. The other thing I would do, though, is I think what I would plan on is having some things that you can easily pass. Like I would do a very, I would do whole sugar snap peas. And I would just drop them in boiling water for about a minute, pull them out, throw them in a bowl of ice water, put them, you know, drain them off well, put them in the fridge. And then when you're ready to pass them, or to have someone pass them, you toss them with coarse salt. They're absolutely fabulous with drinks. You wouldn't believe. The same thing with cherry tomatoes. And this is a case where if you're going to do it as a buffet hors d'oeuvre party, if you have anything that's a compote, like a stand, anything that's unexpected, like I use clear flower vases, glass. I bought one that looks like a goldfish bowl. And what I do is I put in there with a big old antique silver ladle, a punch with great chunks of floating fruit in there. Because it's really, all it is just a big, you know, vase that you might put tulips in. Is this working for you?
This is great.
This is not work for you.
Right.
This is the kind of thing where everybody's going to love it.
Hey,
congratulations to
you,
too.
Well, thank you very much.
Have
it's
a great party.
To talk to you. Thank you.
Take care.
All righty.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. I have got a find. Now, you have to know, I cannot stand fiddled with pasta. I do not want my pasta colored. I do not want flavorings in it. I don't care what it is. But I came across a pasta that's made by Barilla. It's something new. And it's called Barilla Plus. And here's the deal. What's in this is semolina flour, which is normal for pasta, and then a ton of dried legumes. So there's things like lentils and chickpeas, and then there's grains. There's barley, and there's spelt, and there's actually ground flaxseed. Now, most of this healthy kind of pasta stuff is really great when you read the label, and then you try to put it in your mouth, and you can't eat it. This stuff is good. But one of the tricks is don't overcook it. So it's called Barilla Plus. Take a look. Give it a shot. See what you think. Well, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have got Beverly calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Beverly, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I was in Japan a few years ago, and at a sort of roadside stand, there was a lot of ice cream.
Uh-huh.
And there were many flavors I'd never heard of before. So I had to choose one, and that was sesame, but the one I thought I was going to try later and never saw again was tomato ice cream. And I've been able to find tomato ice cream recipes on the internet, but I think they're all from the American point of view, and I'd really like to know what Japanese tomato ice cream is like.
Oh, boy. I don't think I've ever had Japanese tomato ice cream, but I know, I mean, I've had the ginger and the green tea and that kind of thing, and the formulation doesn't seem to be all that different. Did you find the ice cream there had a different feel to it?
The one I tried was sesame, and I think it was a little more tarry, but other than that...
A little more tarry, you said?
Tarry,
like tar?
Yeah.
That's probably because it was roasted sesames that had been ground on it. Yeah, and they would have a really strong... Tarry describes it really well in some ways.
It's a wonderful flavor.
I think if there is a difference, and this is an educated guess, it's the difference that makes gelato, Italy's gelato, slightly different, and that is that it may be a little leaner. But, you know, I would try the tomato ice cream. This would be my thought, okay? I would take really intensely flavored tomatoes, okay? I would not seed them. I would not peel them. I would puree them with a little salt, and I would push them through a sieve. And then that would go into my warm cream that I would then cool down and use that as the base of making the ice cream. Or I would, if you're using a custard-based formula, I would just leave them in the custard and make the ice cream. The other thing that you could do, which would be kind of interesting, is to take those same really intense sweet acid tomatoes and puree them and cook them down with sugar until you've intensified that sweetness.
Uh-huh.
And then take that and strain it, or not. I mean, you could have texture, but and then put that into the base and then make the ice cream. You'll get two different things there. One will be this real intense, sweet, tomato-y flavor, and the other one will be much more delicate. But whatever you do, make sure that base is really intense in flavor, because when things are served cold or frozen, every flavor is muted.
Yeah.
It's like you've wrapped a blanket around them.
Yep.
And yeah, you know, and really, it's one of the mistakes people make when they first start improvising ice creams is they're too delicate. And you really need to have it taste before you freeze it, you know, pretty powerful, because by the time it's frozen, it's going to be muted down. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew more about Japanese ice cream, but my sense is, from what I've had in a couple of very good Japanese restaurants, is that the formulation is not that different.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds like somebody created tomato ice cream, and there's absolutely no reason why tomato wouldn't make dynamite ice cream, because it's sweet sour.
Yeah, I'm a little curious about squid ice cream, though.
Now, that is a whole other issue. That is really... But the other thing that's happening a lot is savory ice creams, you know, like truffle ice cream. I mean, in so many words, things made with very little sugar.
Yeah.
I've had garlic ice cream. It was dynamite. And then there is the cheater's way to do green chili and avocado ice cream. And what you do is you take...
Avocado.
Yeah. I mean, you essentially puree avocado with a really sparkly green chili like a serrano or a jalapeno, and you blend that into softened vanilla ice cream with a lot of salted pistachio nuts, shelled and salted pistachio nuts, and you freeze it. And and a little vanilla. And it's fabulous.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for starting our thinking in new directions, Beverly. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Ina on the line from Longmont, Colorado. Ina, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about my genuine bronzeware made by hand in Siam.
Uh-huh.
which I purchased about, 40 years ago at a flea market. And I was going through the usual places, scavenging things for a charity silent auction.
Right, right.
And someone said, how about that cutlery? Let's get rid of it. And I said, you know, I'm not sure the agency has that much insurance. Because it's bronze ware. It is Victorian in its
it sounds big.
Number of pieces. It's a service for 12, and there are about 10 different pieces for each place setting.
Oh, this is probably a case where there's the fork for the little cake and the fork for the large cake and the
right.
ice cream.
Right, and there are seafood forks.
Oh, yeah.
Everything except the iced teaspoons, what I would call an iced teaspoon, is has the cyan Buddha on the top of the implement.
How beautiful.
It appears to be ebony on the handle. And on the back, what appears to be a hallmark, if you take your grandson's magnifier and look at it,
yes.
has the initials SBF, and then underneath it, Siam.
SBF.
And but the iced teaspoons have no marking on the back, but on the front they say Thailand.
They may have been added later.
It would appear. And they seem to be brown.
That's interesting.
Because the rest of it is black. But, I would hate to donate it to the silent auction and then have someone poisoned.
Bronze, from what I understand, there was a time when I thought I wanted a bronze pot. And what I discovered was that bronze is made of several different metals, and different formulations are made in different parts of the world. Different formulations were made at different times. But the main ingredient is copper, and one of the ingredients that's pretty constant in it is lead.
Okay.
And both of those things can be toxic.
Yes.
But it sounds so spectacular. I mean, this is the kind of thing that collectors, I'm sitting here drooling thinking I may never eat with it, but boy, could you figure out a way to display it?
You know, I have enjoyed cutlery all my life. My grandmother had a marvelous collection. She was married during the Edwardian period.
Oh.
And she lived in southeastern Ireland, in Wexford, and she came from a family of auctioneers.
Oh, talk about nirvana.
Yes. So
she had
a marvelous collection of different kinds of cutlery.
You know what I'm thinking? I don't think I'd put it in the auction unless you wanted to give away something that could have great value. If nothing else, fascination for scholars. You have a lot of utterly fascinating research to do. You are going to have the best time, and then I'll tell you what's going to happen next. You're going to start collecting, and you're going to end up with cupboards that look like mine. No, but seriously, don't give it away. It's too precious, and it may lead you down some utterly fascinating paths in terms of what the world was like when it was made.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Oh, Ina, thank you. I'm just having a lovely time here. Hey, thanks.
Love the show. My book club is addicted.
Oh, thank you. I'm very complimented. Thanks a lot, Ina.
Oh, bye.
Goodbye. Talk about what gets me going. Okay, you can call us, 800-537-5252. Globalization takes on new meaning when you place your order at that fast food drive-up window. Now, I'm not talking about the food. I'm talking about the voice you hear. New York Times business journalist Matt Richtel has the story. Matt, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell me, what's happening at the drive-up window?
Well, what's happening at the drive-up window is an effort to make fast food even faster and more efficient and optimize customer service by creating call centers dedicated to taking your drive-through order when you come up to a McDonald's. And it's just happening in a handful of places in a relative sense, maybe 50 or 60 McDonald's, and I understand that Carl's Jr. may be trying this soon. The idea is that when you drive up to the window, automatically, an operator is notified somewhere in this case, Santa Maria, California.
So no matter where you are, it's going to Santa Maria, California.
No matter where you are, it's going to Santa Maria, California, where dedicated drive-through taking specialists are at the ready.
Talk about specialization. But how does this save time?
Well, it's a great question. I'll say this. It doesn't save much of it. But we're in an era where it seems like every second counts. The idea is that it takes 10 seconds for a car on average to pull up from the drive-through to the window where they pick up food. And in theory, in those 10 seconds, the person answering the phone in Santa Maria could begin taking a call somewhere else. And by the time you pull up, someone else who had taken a call from your McDonald's is now taking a call from Honolulu.
So you're talking literally seconds in difference.
We are talking seconds in difference, but I should say that there is another aim here, and that is to enable the people who are in the call center to be highly focused on their task. They know better than anyone perhaps ever has how to ask if you want pickles or lettuce or mayonnaise, and by virtue of so doing, they're not running between taking your order and filling your order. Such a highly competitive business that if you can find one edge as an operator of a McDonald's or a Carl's Jr., your line takes less long for someone to go through, you mess up someone's order less often, you're liable to build loyalty in a business that is often seen as a commodity. But I would just say there, is this technology run amok? Is this efficiency for efficiency's sake? And I do think it's an indication, an illustration of people finding that edge. How much efficiency is too much efficiency, or where can we find it that we haven't found it before? And I think we're exploring that border right here.
Matt, is this technique being worked anywhere else? You said Carl's Jr., the chain that's on the West Coast, and McDonald's. Anybody else using this concept?
Carl's Jr., I think, is poised to do it. I do know that Wendy's is eschewing this idea. They say it's not proven to them cost-effective, and they are considered one of the leaders among the chains of speeding up time. So I can't say right now that this portends widespread use of the remote order taker, but we'll see.
Well, thanks for talking with us, Matt.
Thank you.
Matt Richtel is business journalist with the New York Times. His article, The Long Distance Journey of a Fast Food Order, appeared in the April 11th, 2006 issue of the paper. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Chris O'Brien. He said, "The journey of 1,000 pounds begins with a single burger." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found at our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. And you can download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. Sign up for both online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Hefty, maker of the Hefty OneZip, a food storage bag designed to close the first time, every time. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Donaff. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week, and be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.